Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's June 22nd, 2012. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Just a quick note, today I am married 16 years.
Oh, congratulations.
Thanks. All these anniversaries and things that are going on in our world, and happens to be one with the wife, too. So, wow, happy
very
anniversary.
Nice. Congratulations. I will not be sending you a gift. You are fishing for one.
Oh, just hearing your voice every week is a gift alone.
That is very true. That is very true.
I mean, you know, we also, like you said last week, our magazine is 4 years old this week, too, in a couple of days, so... Just pretty remarkable stuff for any milestones.
Milestone City, baby. Oh, shoot, I was going to jump right into the second item. Let's go jump into the second item because I have a better segue. Then we'll go back to our first item. Speaking of milestones, once a month, Gundam, our lovable, cuttable?
This is why we have to have you on the show, because we have lovable, to have words made up every week.
Lovable, cuddly Gundam. wants to be sure that we have a debate about feel versus math on the forum. And it's essentially the same argument every single time. But it's you know, it's like watching Jersey Shore. You know Snooki's going to get drunk and fall over, but you watch it anyhow, right? So that's the same thing we have with this feel versus math. But you think, and I'll hold my laughter, but you think you have cracked the code here.
Well, what made me think that was that when I finally posted something that I thought was pretty good, our good friend Rant was on there as well, and he said that that post that I posted was a good one. And he generally falls in the same camp as Gundam when it comes to this argument. So when he said that what I posted was good, then I felt like, all right, we've cracked the code. We've discovered a way that we could refer to this without totally ruffling everyone's feathers. Make a quick recap here. On anteupmagazine.com/forum, in the Anteup PokerCast recaps, under the thread that was for the Lee Child show when we had him on discussing advanced strategies, during the show I had said something about feel, you know, feel player or something like that. And it had been a while. You know, it had gotten under the radar, I thought, because no one had said anything. And then I guess Gundam was behind on shows, so when he finally listened to it, he posted, you know, like 2 weeks after that show, saying, oh, Chris said it. And then I'm like, what did I say? And I'm reading it, and then he talks about the feel and goes on and on about the feel thing again. So what the problem is that there are people out there who believe that they're just having these feelings in a hand, and that when you feel something, whether it's the person strong or weak, they think it's just a feeling, and they're folding or raising based on a feeling only, and they don't consider it math, or they don't consider it anything to do with math. Now, I'm pretty sure we're going to hear later in the show that you should not be singing.
Oh, okay.
But
I got to get out of my system then before.
You better stop doing it. So when he wrote that again, I think in the past, I don't even know if I've actually argued this or not on the forum or not, but I finally got involved this time, and I said, I'm not going to get sucked into the vortex, but I am going to explain the shorthand of this, which is exactly what you said it was. It's just that we're just saying it's shorthand for saying that we are doing the weighing the things in our head, because that's the key thing there, is the weighing. That's where they think it's math. Weighing it, and then since you're weighing it, you're putting a weight on it. Putting a weight on it is a percentage, and then it's math. So,
yeah. And it is. It is math regardless of whether we know we're doing it.
Right. Whether you know you're doing it or not, you are using some sort of calculation, hence, ergo, you are using math. So what I had written was, I look at math the way my teachers in elementary school taught it to me. And when I know that there is one thing here and there's one thing here, and I put those two things together, it adds up to something. So when I say 1 plus 1 equals 2, to me that's tangible math, because I know that there's one there and I know that there's one there. And when you put them together, you make two things. So I was saying that when you're positive of something, like I have an apple in this hand, I have an apple in this hand, I put them together, I have two apples. It is a tangible math problem that I can figure out. It's basic. It's ABC to me.
It's guaranteed.
It's guaranteed. It's something
absolutely
that you...
100% accurate.
Right. You cannot deny.
There's no room for discussion over how many apples you have.
Right. Point. Exactly. There's no room for discussion. You may want to try to say that it's not, but it is. It's one apple here, one apple there. Put them together, you have two apples. That's a tangible math problem in my mind.
Are you going to share one of those apples with me?
I will, but then I won't have to, because we can use tangible math and know that if I give you one, I now have one apple.
Kind of like apples. Even though they make my ears swell up.
It's funny you say that, because if I eat apples, my throat swells up.
Yeah.
I can't eat apples unless they're cooked. So a little peek into the lives of Will Hopper here. All right, so the other term then would be intangible math, in that there are these percentages that you are assigning things that are unknown, but you can relatively take these unknown things and give them a good percentage based on the information that you are gathering, the incomplete information you are gathering. And so, yes, you are weighing these factors, and therefore it is a mathematical thing, but you cannot be 100% correct in this weight of things. Only in your mind you could be that way, but the fact is you'll never know if there truly were, you know, a 57% chance this person's going to fold if I raise. You just don't know that. So by it not being concrete, that it can't be disputed, we have to call it intangible math. So we have to call it...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have a bushel of apples in my backpack, or I could have a peck of apples.
That's right. And you don't know.
Because you can't see into my backpack.
You can't see into his backpack. So there's a good chance, based on the size of apples, that you know this general average size of apples and the size of Scott's bag, that it's probably closer to a bushel than it is to a peck. But you don't know for certain, so it has to be intangible math. You can't be specific. You can't be indisputed. So I have said that from now on, when I say feel, and when Scott says feel, in the terms of describing what kind of player we're talking about or what kind of player we are saying we are intangible math play. We're not intangible. We're not using. We're intangible math is what we're using, is what we're saying. So we're intangible math players.
The Pod Odd Show will follow the show.
We're intangible math players.
Intangible math. Okay.
In that we can't... When I use math, I use it for very specific things. If they say the bet is 500, I know that math indicates that I have to throw a 500 units out there chip to make a call. That's tangible to me. So I'm saying that I'm mostly using intangible math than feel when I'm trying to figure out if this guy is eye-blinking, tells me that I should fold, you know. So that's why I put it on the post. I said intangible math is the kind of player I am, and a tangible math player is someone who relies solely, or not solely, but relies specifically on that kind of math, and not relies, but, you know, tends to use that more than not. And so that's what we feel like. I think intangible and tangible.
No chance at all this will get picked apart
nope.
At the forum. Not at all. Because that was a crystal clear explanation.
Well, you know, it's funny that you wouldn't think that just on having a show and talking about being a field player versus a math player would create such a stir, and it does. And it's people have their reasons, and it's fine. And that's the way they feel, and that's the way we feel. That's the way I intangible math it, and that's the way you intangible math it.
I've got a feeling.
As Boston would say, it's more than intangible math-ing.
More than intangible math.
more than... See, I'm not singing like you, because that's... Yeah, okay. I'm going to get in trouble, so... But anyway, I hope that maybe we've kind of put a little discussion down and made it so that, okay, we understand what you mean, just understand what we mean, and let's move on.
You're so cute, Chris.
It's not going to happen, but we're trying. We're doing our best.
Put it down. All right, but we'd like to have a little fun. You know, it's 4 years next week that we started the company, and we're coming up on our starting our fourth year of actually producing magazines, right?
Yeah.
And talk about the milestones. Well, you found that some evidence that we really truly have arrived, right?
Yeah, I think so.
You were shopping eBay for apples last week, apparently. And came across some entrepreneur out there who is trying to piggyback on our success by selling the mint, by the way, that's very important.
Yeah.
When you're talking about publications or baseball cards or gum flavors, mint copy of our very first issue ever, Chris, from May 2011. And I'll stop so everybody can do the quick math there. And if you can't figure out, you can use your feelings to figure out that that is not our first issue ever. But this listing, he was very definitive. Get your piece of poker history, a brand new magazine, first copy ever, and it was more than you can buy it on our site.
I know, that's pretty funny. You could actually get it from us for less.
$5. I forget what he was. It was at least $6 or something.
Yeah, it was like $6.99 or something. I don't really recall. That was a little while ago, but unbelievable. And you know what's really funny about this, and we haven't said anything yet about that, but you and I had the exact same thought when we saw this listing.
And that's never good for us.
When we were...
Checks and balances are what keep us in business.
It was last year, right? When we were in Vegas and we heard that story. It was last year, yeah. We were talking to the Flamingo Poker Room manager, and he says, oh, yeah, anti-ups, man, they go quick. And I'm like, really? And he's like, yeah, you know, because... And we even have to kind of, like, beat off the homeless, because they come in and take them and try to sell them for $1 on the strip. You and I had the exact same thought, that the homeless got the internet, and they're starting to sell our magazines online now.
Yeah, they're no longer, I mean, they're entrepreneurs just like we are. They're no longer satisfied with the 100% $1 profit. They want to go down to the public library and get a 6 times that amount.
Man.
Minus shipping and handling.
And then I actually found this on other, I think it was on Amazon, too. It was not only just eBay, but it was on Amazon.
Yeah.
People are just selling them everywhere.
Yeah, so... So obviously, you know, we're not trying to kill this guy's business model here, but do know, make sure you verify that if you really do want the first issue ever, that it is the first issue ever. I even sent him an email saying, hey, dude, do you know who I am? And I didn't get a response back. So, don't make that mistake out there. Right? And, of course, you know, you can buy it straight from us.
Yeah, that's right. I actually have a bunch of the actual real first issues, and if you guys want to buy them for me for $50, I'll sell them to you. What the hell?
49 here. 49.
Oh, you're 48 here. I'll go 48.
48, 40, oh boy, I'm not going to go a dime below 46.
All right. Our hotline, 813-448-1120. Longtime listener Everett from St. Louis calls in this week, has an interesting question.
Hey, this is Everett, St. Louis. A lot of players call others nitter nitty, and I can't stand this term because I think I slipped into that realm. But shouldn't we all kind of be playing nitty poker? And how should I bet with other games and with side pots? Bad beats, high hands, aces cracked. Thanks.
Okay, well, I'll take the nitty part if you take the betting part. How's that sound?
Excellent.
All right. Should
Sounds
we
like
all be nitty
characters? Follow along the wacky adventures of
nitty and side pot. Oh, nitty. Okay, well, a nit obviously means that you're really tight and that you don't part with money very easily at the table or in life. Should we all be nitty? Maybe. I only am nitty when the play around me dictates it. I think that if I get a bunch of wild and wacky guys named Sidepot next to me, I think that I'll I'll maybe tighten up a little bit and really catch him in a bad way and get a big pot off him. But if I got a bunch of nits around me who are taking your advice, I will definitely loosen up and steal a lot of pots from them. And so, yeah, I think being nitty is a good basic plan to head into at a table when you don't understand how everybody's playing yet. But once you understand and they're all loose, yeah, be nitty. But if they're all tight, well, then you might want to loosen up and not be such a nit. So that's how I look at it when I play.
Yeah, maybe I misunderstood what you were saying, but I think there shouldn't be any kind of negative connotation to being called nit.
Yeah,
necessarily, because it is a solid strategy. You can't lose what you can't put in the pot, right?
Yeah,
so you can't win anything, you know, either though, right? You know, it's that one half of the microdermot versus the second half, right? So you know, I think people make a bigger mistake by being ridiculously aggressive, not knowing what they're doing, versus being ridiculously nitty, not knowing what they're doing.
Mm. Well,
at some point, you need to be in the middle. But
I mean, if you did wonder if it was a negative thing, I mean, I think there is a negative connotation to it. Not that being a nit is bad, but that people use that term.
Right? There shouldn't be.
Yeah, there shouldn't be, and people use that term like it's a negative thing. But you know, if somebody's not busting your chops, they'll call you tight. If they're busting your chops, they'll call you a nit. So
that's true.
You know what I mean? So that there is a negative connotation, but I think that you should be a tight player until you know what's going on, and unless you're crazy, wacky, and don't want to. But there is some solid truth to the quality of play.
I'm gonna reach out to the fellow nits around the country, and maybe we'll have a march on Washington or something.
Or you do like Revenge of the Nerds at the end, and you'll grab the microphone from the football.
I'm
coach.
A nit. You're a nit.
I can't sing. Can't sing, yeah, buddy.
We'll even have the cute cheerleader come up. I'm a nit.
I'm in love with a nit. All right. What about the second half of his question here? He has about side pots.
Yeah, this
and stuff.
Is a lot of it depends on what we're talking about. So side pots and he's mentioned Ace is Cracked and somebody. It depends on which one of those things are going on. But and they're two completely different issues too. I mean, like Ace is Cracked is a promotion. So when we're talking about promotions, I always try to just fully understand how the promotion works and then how people will change their approach to it, because there are players out there that don't care about Ace is Cracked or, you know, hitting a high hand or something like that. They're there to play poker the way poker should be, right?
Yeah.
And then you have other people that if they lose $1,000 during the day but they get their Aces Cracked and get $100, they'll go home with a wife and, like, they just won the World Series of Poker main event, right?
Right.
So a lot of it's understanding how the players play it. And then knowing what the promotion is, and it helps, I think it helps on hand ranges too. You know, if somebody gets an extra $300 for playing in 7-deuce and winning with it, and there's a 7 and deuce on the board and the action's pretty crazy, there's a bigger incentive for them to have played the worst starting hand in poker, and therefore there's a higher probability that they actually have it there. Doesn't mean that they have it, but it just, you know, you have to adjust to what it means.
Right.
Now, side pots? I don't know, boy. This is like kind of a question like, how do you play poker, isn't it?
Yeah.
It depends. I mean, I know a lot of people get skewered by other players for betting into a dry side pot, but that's not always wrong. I mean, if you've got a short stack that's all in, and you and another huge stack at the table are going heads up for the rest of the hand, there's a lot of chips to be won by the two of you that aren't in the pot yet.
Yeah.
So to say you should check it down, you're betting into a dry side pot. No, I'm trying to get value for my hand. That's the ultimate thing, I guess. I mean, can you get value for your hand out of it?
And it totally changes in cash games. Cash games, you know, I mean, I'm not even thinking about it.
Oh, absolutely.
It doesn't matter. I mean, we're going for money here. We're not worried about knocking a player out and moving up in pay scale or anything like that. We're just playing, and you know, the amount that you're playing for is still the same. So, and the other thing too is if you're in a tournament and your intangible math senses go off and you know that you know, you're not going to win the main pot, but you want to try to get some money out of the other guy, I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, if you could just know that you're going to be beating the guy that you're in the side pot with and you want to get some money out of him, there's no reason not to bet. You know, I mean, I can see the reason for checking it down. But the, you know, if you know you're not going to win the main pot because you did it, you're in the big blind, you got a crappy hand, but you might be able to beat the other guy who came in to try to knock out another guy. There's no reason not to bet.
Yeah, you know, this always gets contentious, I think. I mean, it's part of tournament strategy. That's why tournaments are, in my opinion, cooler than cash games, because there's more to consider. Yeah. That doesn't mean, you know, you should play tournaments over cash games. I just think there's more to consider. And you do have to consider whether you, what that means. But, you know, I think there's kind of this blanket expectation out there that when you have an all-in player that you're supposed to check it down and knock them out, and that's ridiculous, I think.
Yeah.
There are times where that makes absolute perfect sense and you should do that, but there's other times where, you know, forget that. I'm trying to get those other chips here. And that came up, actually, this tournament this week that I final tabled again, by the way. Obvious brag post. I mean, we were still, like, two tables left. And somebody was all in, and I was playing against another stack, and she bet into me into a dry side pot, and I folded, and I saw some smirks from people, like, she shouldn't have done that. And I mean, obviously I wish she didn't, because I might have had a chance to win the pot, but she was playing the way I would have played there. It's way too early to worry about knocking somebody out when you have a lot of chips from somebody else you can get, so... I guess the short answer to Everett is consider the situation. You know, I don't think there's any hard and fast rule. That might be an interesting book for somebody to write.
Oh, jeez.
How to play versus all these crazy promotions. And then, you know, maybe an app even. You flip to an old pocket ace, Aces Cracked. How do I play now?
Yeah, Aces Cracked, I always think I'm just going to let as many people as possible into the hand when I have aces and not bet them until the end, as long as there's a minimum amount. That needs to be
See, that even depends, though. But, I mean, yeah, it could be. I mean, to me, the ace is cracked as an insurance policy. If I have aces, I know that if I lose this hand, I'm getting $100 back. But at the same time, you know, I see people try to – they get all twisted at this point. Because at that point, you need to figure out the best value to get. I mean, if you're playing heads up and you win the pot and you win $20 from someone – you lost value there. If you could get $100 back and you didn't put $100 into the pot, you know?
Well, the only thing about it is that there's no risk in the way that, you know, if you have, don't forget, you're not playing. A lot of people think, oh, I'm going to sit down at 1-2 and buy in for 100, and if I lose my stack, I'm fine, I'm getting 100 back. But, you know, I'll play where I buy in for 5 or 300.
Right.
And I don't want to risk 500 to win 100. So.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah,
so
I just.
It all depends on your ship stack and what else is going on, and. You know, if you're right, if you got 500 in front of you and you limp in and you let a bunch of people come in and you lose the hand and it ends up, you end up putting more than $100 in the pot, then you end up played it suboptimal rather than optimal. You know what I mean? So it all depends on all that kind of stuff. But I mean, that's the kind of stuff you have to consider when you have those promotions. And also, you know, I think we talked about this on some other folks, you know, some other show. You know, you have to know what the promotion is. Sometimes you have to have $20 in the pot for the payoff or something like that. So I've seen people make mistakes like that, too, where they check it down and, ha-ha, steel wheel, ship it. They're like, sorry, there's $18 in the pot. It needs to be $20. What? So, you know, I mean, the bottom line is just understand the promotion, all the rules for promotion, and just think how that changes how you play, and that'll help you figure out how it changes how everybody else plays.
Yeah.
All right, Irvin, of course, you've been hit with the swag deck lately, but everybody else, call 813-448-1120, and we will send you something awesome.
All right, a mailbag comes from Matt Moody, and it's about home game soft play. He said, I was wondering what both of you think about enforcing the TDA rule of raising/re-raising with the absolute nuts in a home cash game. TDA rules for tournaments, but I know what he's saying, so... Within the last 2 weeks...
Well, actually, let's pause. He said a World Series rule, and I corrected
him. Oh, okay, he said World Series. Well, even so, it's World Series still tournaments.
Yeah.
But within the past 2 weeks, a player in a local cash game I play in have checked or check-called a river with the absolute nuts. In my opinion, there is absolutely no reason for this soft play, and it is really starting to annoy me because both players know better. I don't think having a severe penalty for a home game is necessary, such as the pot going to the other player or players in the hand, chopped if there's more than two players in the hand. But maybe the player could pay a penalty to the bad beat, Can't wait to hear your take. What do you think, Scott?
Well, you know, I think you stumbled on the most important word in this thing was cash game.
Right.
You know, the rules for this are for tournaments because tournaments are a communal thing. Now, I mean, there is a small consideration for cash game soft play going on, but it's a much bigger transgression, I think, in my mind, in a tournament. So the cash game, I don't know. I guess I don't really have... I'm not outraged in a cash game by this. I mean, I would prefer that people play competitively in my home game. But I don't know whether it needs to go to the step of a penalty. Now, if the home game turns into a tournament and people have developed these bad habits and they continue the tournament, that's a problem. So that's probably a reason to kind of address it. But I think he's even saying that the players know better and they just don't want to do it. So... That's a tough thing, I think, in a home game. I mean, that's one of the things we talk about with home games is, making sure everybody's comfortable with the rules and happy. It's your first and foremost, you're there to have fun.
Right. Two things come to mind here. One, whenever somebody talks about a rule in a home game, I always think of, the signs that are posted in the old days, where it says, no check raising. That kind of thing. Well, this is your house, so if you're running your home game, it's what you allow. So, Matt, if it's your game, then you can make up rules that you want to be enforced in your game, and you tell everybody. But the other thing you should probably do is have a little meeting with these guys beforehand and say, okay, look, I play for a particular reason, and that reason is to get better and is to, to be competitive. And you guys are playing and not betting at the end because you're playing with friends. Now, are we going to have a friendly game, or are we going to have a game where we're still trying to win as much as we can because that's why we're here? And then you have a little meeting about it. And if they all decide, you know what, it's just a friendly game, let's not really, then you just have to go with the majority. And if you don't want to play in that home game anymore, then you don't. But really, having a meeting with your friends and saying, look, it's really bothering me that we're not playing to the best of our ability and we're not trying to get as much value out of our hands as we can, because these are rules that if you played in the tournament, you'd get a penalty for. So if you're getting penalized for in a tournament, then shouldn't we be playing the way we would play if we go out in the real world? And then see what they say and have a conversation about it. Because I think that you're right. If you're being frustrated by it, then something should be done. And whether it's you leaving that home game or accepting it or them changing the limits so that it's not that big of a deal if somebody can only bet 10 cents at the end, or some weird way to make you happy, then that's what should happen. But I think a meeting of the minds should probably happen so that you can clear your conscience of it and just move on.
Yeah, the best part of that is just to explain why it's such a big deal.
Yeah.
And, some people may not agree with you that it's that big a deal, but at least explaining so people understand why, you're supposed to be betting your hand regardless of who you're playing, regardless of the situation. Maybe that'll help. I mean, he says they should know better, but maybe they don't know better.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an issue that's come up on our show four or five times now, and every time it comes up, we get more emails. Hey, I never heard that before. So it's not as common as some other stuff out there. So it's quite possible maybe these folks just don't understand the concept.
And the other thing, too, is that it gives the impression of collusion, or that player A is much closer to player B as friends, and he doesn't want to hurt player B, but yet who might go all in against player C, and that's not right, because why are you trying to get as much money out of player C but not out of player A? So the one time that you don't bet the nuts, it's going to look fishy, but then when you do bet the nuts, why are you doing it against me, not against him? Because you guys are better
friends.
We're
not even fishy, but that's a potential of rubbing people the wrong way.
Yeah, yeah.
Basso soft played you, Chris, but then he raised me, so what's the deal?
Yeah, because we're both Italian.
That's probably why, absolutely. And he has more apples than you.
He has more apples.
All right, Matt. Hopefully you can break the ice to your next home game with this discussion with a wonderful deck of J-Design playing cards, official playing cards of Annie Up. We will be happy to send those to you. And everyone else, you can either get one by sending us a mailbag or question to podcast@annieupmagazine.com or go straight to annieupstore.com and buy some.
Okay, call the four this week. Peter DeLuca says, I've been a loyal listener to the podcast for about 6 months. All right, Pete, thanks for finding us.
Sure.
Definitely enjoy the content and discussion of hands, strategy, etc. I recently was playing in a sit-and-go. Started with 10 players, we were down to 4, and we were going to pay out 3. I had a decent-sized stack, I raised three times with a king-queen suited, and I was the dealer. Got one caller. Flop was king-king-ace. The other player went all in. I called. We flipped our cards, and he sees that I have trip kings. He leaves the table with his cards flipped over. He had a low pocket pair. The final two cards are ace-ace, so it is a split pot, but he left the table. Should we have tracked him down to let him know that he was still alive? We continued play, and I collected all the chips. Should those chips have been split among the players that were still playing?
All right, well, this was an easy one. So easy that we can take it. We don't need to call
Jody and wake him up.
Like Jody, yeah, exactly. It's way early out there on the West Coast. But no, I mean, yeah, the player and his chips are still alive in the tournament. I would think in a real poker room, the dealer or somebody would, or the other players would shout, "Hey, you're still alive." It happens almost every tournament I'm in.
Yeah.
You know, somebody walks away and thinks that they recovered. And by the time they get the chips counted down, "Hey, you're still alive." And sometimes I've seen people chase them all the way to the elevator and bring them back. So, yeah, I think there's an expectation. Obviously, the player should not leave the hand until he's been officially killed.
Right.
So, I mean, he takes some responsibility. But I would make a fair effort to try to get him. But if you can't find him, then you're definitely not splitting those chips off. Those chips are his. He might come back in 20 minutes and go, "Hey, wait a minute. Did I win that hand?" Maybe he forgot his jacket or something, he comes back, and his stack should still be there. I mean, obviously he gets blinded off until he's out of the tournament, but that's the deal.
Okay, right? So now Peter DeLuca has a short stack. He goes all on next hand. Another guy calls, he goes out. We give this guy his money, right?
You know, we did have this question before, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah.
I can't remember what the answer was.
And he deserves his money, because still his stack still survived.
Yeah.
Because what if he went
yeah.
to the bathroom and then came back? You know what I mean? You don't know where he went. So now you got to find the guy in life and mail him his money or something.
I just got
it. You can't just...
Put it out on Craigslist. Are you the moron that left the poker table with a low pocket pair, didn't realize that we ended up chopping, and you ended up winning the tournament in absentia?
Oh, man.
Please call AppleGuy789. I've got your money.
You cannot contact this poster.
But yeah, short answer, he's still alive, and just blind him off, and hopefully you don't have that situation where he actually wins. That would be
brutal.
Of course, actually, we're down to what it pays. Did he say he paid three?
Yeah, it paid top three.
Yeah, yeah, so I mean, it's very likely that he'll still get some money, depending on how the rest of the tournament plays out. But that's the deal. So, all right, Peter, we appreciate you sending that in. We will be happy to send you a T-shirt from PMS Pokerwear, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the AnnieUp store at AnnieUpStore.com. And everybody else, email us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com. And if it's more complicated than it sounds, which it usually is, we'll be happy to let our poker room manager, Julia Russell, take a swing at it and get back with a very professional answer for you.
And then real quick, too, if he actually survived heads up, then he can't win heads up, right? Because he'd have to be present for his hand to be alive, right? And have to be a dead hand at the end.
Yeah, we think so, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, we got a feedback call this week. Usually our feedback is emails, but our good friend Poker Geek, our Minnesota ambassador for the magazine, said someone on this broadcasting team doesn't necessarily have perfect pitch.
Hello, AnnieUp Nation. This is Poker Geek here. I just finished listening to the 7-Year Itch show, and I have to say, never in my life, have I heard anything as horrible as Scott singing. Please, please never repeat that. Despite that, it was still a great show. Keep up the good work.
Ah, oh, Geek, I can't stop loving you.
Oh, no. That's it, right? That's the last thing you're going to sing?
I guess I've been retired before my career even took off.
It was a beautiful moment.
America's Podcasters Got Talent next week, but I'm going to have to let them know that I've been excommunicated by the Antioch Nation.
Sorry, bud. You know, when I heard it was such a shock. If you had told me before the show you had planned on singing a chorus of something, I would have totally vetoed it. But you didn't let me, so I apologize to the AnnieUp Nation for exposing them to that. Hopefully yeah, they didn't have a turn
it's
too
really
up.
Your own fault, too, because you're like, hey, I'm going to keep my little secret. I don't want you to see it.
I still didn't know you were going to sing.
So I'm like, fine, I'm going to keep my little secret, too. I can play that game. And then I'm going to, like, sing and then really drive you crazy. So I'm pretty sure that might have been the last show, second to last show that I sang on, obviously. And last show that we keep anything from each other. Because who knows what I'm going to do next time you do that.
Oh, my God. All right. Hey, don't forget, we're still looking for votes to get this small business grant. We need 250 votes by June 30th to be considered. Very easy, free way to support Anti Up. We had about 110 votes at the time of this taping, so we still need a good 140 votes. You know, we have thousands of listeners and thousands of followers and thousands of Facebook friends, so hopefully just 140 or so of you more will go to this site for us. It's missionsmallbusiness.com, and we have a link to it on our forum, but if you can't get there, then just type in the address and go there. And I think you have to have a Facebook account, right, Sky? Is that right? Which kind of ticks me off.
You said you didn't, right?
I thought I didn't, but apparently, well, here's what happened. When I voted for us, I voted for us on my computer, not like my laptop or anything, and apparently my wife was on the computer before me. So it automatically logged me in as my wife as a Facebook voter. So I voted as her, not realizing. So yeah, I think you have to be a Facebook, have a Facebook account or whatever, which kind of really ticks me off. I don't think that should be right. But anyway, hopefully you have a Facebook account and you guys will vote for us because, we could use a grant.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I mean, they got the money. We don't right now. So, when we get all rich and famous after we get this grant and turn it into a lot of money, then we'll set up our own thing and we'll make it so you don't have to have a Facebook account.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what we'll do.
Right now, the man has all the power, so we got to play by his rules. So,
but, we'll never do that. Like, look at this. Here's our survey, right? You don't have to have a Facebook account to vote in our survey.
Nope.
It's our annual survey. Go to antiupmagazine.com/survey. Have your voice heard and be entered for thousands of dollars of great prizes, including one of the best grand prizes I've ever seen, a lunch and one-hour lesson from world champion Chris Moneymaker. How cool is that?
Absolutely.
And you don't need to have a Facebook account.
You need to have an email address. Of course, if you don't have an email address, you're not going to find out that you won lunch with Chris Moneymaker.
It's true.
But yeah, go ahead and take that. We've had a lot of people take that already. So, hey, if we could have gotten everybody that took the survey to vote for us on Mission Small Business, then we would have been to the phase two.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll make that part of the thing next year. All right, then remember, this is the last time you're going to hear us whine about meetups, but we're headed to Vegas here very soon, and we'll be crashing Karina Jett's weekly 6-12 mixed game at MGM Grand on Wednesday, June 27th. And, of course, you're not forced to play mixed games. We'll get together some kind of hold'em game for folks that want to play that. But come out and see us. Seem to be getting a lot of interest in that, so it could be a good little group. And then just pay attention to Twitter, and you'll get more details on the smaller meetup in New Mexico in Albuquerque on Saturday, June 30th, and also at Isle Blackhawk in Colorado on July 1st. We'll be doing cash games at some of those casinos in Colorado. We know it's going to be Isle Blackhawk, and New Mexico haven't figured out yet, but all the details will be on Twitter at Antiup Magazine. I'll have to remember to actually tweet on this next trip, Sensei.
We haven't had this in a while. Ambassadors. We're looking for some new ambassadors. Basically, the Reno area. If you live in Central California, you can get to the Reno area. We wouldn't mind having you be one of our ambassadors for the Reno poker scene. And also Deadwood. Scott visited there, and we're going to add them to the magazine for a while and see how that goes. And if you're in the Deadwood area, South Dakota, and want to try to tell us what's going on there every month, we'd like to have you. So go to antiupmagazine.com/ambassadors. And apply for membership.
And don't forget about our cruises, too. We are more than 212 people for our August 27th cruise out of Port Canaveral. Still plenty of giveaways. The Palm Beach Kennel Club, Seminole Hard Rock, Hollywood, Tampa Bay Downs, Ebo Greyhound Park. You can upload a video to Blue Shark Optics Facebook page and win a package. So check those things out. And November 10th, we're sailing out of Baltimore. Dover Downs is giving away prizes monthly there as well, too. And we are hard at work on our 2013 schedule. So if you have any feedback, suggestions on when, where, how we cruise next year, email us at podcast@andyupmagazine.com. And we will take it under advisement.
Okay, let's get our update on the Andy Up News Desk.
Alan Jaffrey Schulman ended a streak of 249 World Series open bracelet events won by men when she beat Dennis Phillips heads up in the Seniors Championship, which was the largest seniors event in history. Former November Niner Elon Schwartz and Joe Cassidy won their first bracelets, while former world champs Joe Catta and Scotty Wynn each had runner-up finishes.
I have a question. How is a seniors event open?
Well, it's open to men and women, I guess, is what they...
Oh, man. Okay. I'm just saying, because, you know, women's event is open to women.
Same thing. They're like, hey, she won an open event. Seniors, I mean, wait a minute, I can't enter that.
Yeah, it's not open to everyone. Open means to everyone.
But at least it's not a... it's not the... I think what they're saying is it's not the ladies' championship.
Oh, yeah, I know. I know what they're saying. It's just weird that...
Oh, that's technically an open event, too.
Yeah, men can't enter it.
Trying not.
They just don't want them to, so...
Right, yeah.
It's kind of silly. All right, whatever. Pinnacle Entertainment, which owns a half dozen U.S. casinos, submitted the winning bid in a bankruptcy auction for the assets of Federated Sports and Casino and Heartland Poker Tour. However, creditors of Federated, including 411 Productions and Savage Tournaments, reportedly believe the sale of Heartland to Federated was fraudulent and want to block All In Entertainment, the former parent company of Heartland, from receiving any money from the auction's proceeds.
Yeah, this just keeps getting more interesting.
Uglier and uglier.
Yeah, Pinnacle's one of the company that actually loaned us money, and then, of course, you know, they the thing went belly up. So
yeah.
So now they're trying to take it over, and Heartland. And this challenge here was just reported by one media outlet. I haven't really followed up on it to see what it means. But, this is going to be quite a while before I think this is all resolved and we know what it means for the Epic Poker League and even Heartland.
I remember when it happened, too, I was thinking to myself, wow, Heartland got bought. Why doesn't anybody buy us and let us run the magazine for gobs of money? And then careful what you wish for.
Yeah, trust me, after I saw what happened to Heartland here, I am not excited about that prospect for us.
Make sure the
check
clears.
I'm happy being little old Annie up right now rather than having those kind of stress buttons.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, finally this week, about 25 groups, including the Christian Coalition, have begun a letter-writing campaign to Congress asking lawmakers to strengthen the UIGEA in light of several states' efforts to create interstate poker networks.
Huh. Well, whatever. I mean, and that's the other thing, too. So it's definitely because of the poker, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're starting to see, you know, Delaware talk about it, New Jersey talk about it, Nevada talk about it, and they're like, whoa, wait a minute. We all know poker's going to destroy every household in the world. We can't have this. What's this going to mean? I don't know. I mean, if you, John Pappas from the PPA said, you know, he kind of dismissed it. He's like, you know, this is not a new argument for these groups. I don't think any of the lawmakers think this is a new argument for them. But at the end of the day, there's people sending letters in, and I think poker players need to match them at least one for one, if not two for one.
Yeah.
So we don't get cocky and think, oh, they already know that these people are against it. Of course, they probably already know the poker players are for it. But, you know, it's all consciousness. It's twisting their consciousness right now. So, you know, if all the letters they're getting are poker's a sin, that's what they're going to remember when they vote.
Yeah.
That's a problem. Well, you know, what's interesting, too, is Pappas was saying that, you know, he's trying to work with these groups to explain, hey, we want to strengthen UIGEA, too, as long as you take poker out of it.
Right, that's what I was getting at, was, you know, if they want to strengthen UIGEA, that's one thing, because that's not poker, that's just a totally different thing. So, yeah, if you want to strengthen it, that's fine, just make sure that poker's not part of it.
Yeah, of course, so, they don't want that. They should be part of everything, so. It's interesting how these bedfellows can get together and help each other out, but don't really want to for whatever reason. So,
well, I know that one thing that's not a sin is completing an O'Malley's move, and we're going to do that today. Let's listen to part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em cash game. The game's been pretty normal for a 1-2 cash game. There are your aggressors, your more timid players, and everything in between. We've bought in for 400 and have been playing well. We're up to nearly 700 at 690. The under-the-gun limps, he's only been here for about 20 minutes, and we haven't seen him voluntarily put chips into the pot yet. All we can go off is his appearance. He's a middle-aged man wearing a casual button-down shirt,
khaki shorts and a baseball cap with a fishing company on it. It gets folded around to the cutoff, who also limps. The button limps, small blind folds, and we're in the big blind with the six of spades, four of spades. Not a bad holding to check our option, so we do. The pot is $6 after the rake, and the flop comes ace of spades, queen of spades, eight of diamonds. We're first to act, and we put $4 into the pot. The under-the-gun calls, as does the cutoff, but the button folds. There's now $16 in the pot, max rake taken out, and the turn is the six of hearts. We have a draw, and now bottom pair, so we're going to fire again. We make it $10 to go, and once again, the under-the-gun calls, but the cutoff folds. We're starting to wish we knew a bit more about this opponent, and even more so when the river brings the jack of spades. There's now $36 in the pot, and we just made our baby flush. So we're going to keep up the aggression. We make it $25 to go, and our opponent shoves for $210. There was only $61 in the pot. What's he trying to accomplish with this bet? And more importantly, what are we going to do?
You know, as this hand played out, I was thinking, our opponent is on a spade draw, too. Please, no, spade on the river. And, of course, that's exactly what we got. So, you know, again, we're out of position, which sucks. We had to bet it. But when we bet it, it opens up to this fresh hell that we face now. That overbet is very odd, I admit. But I'm going to make Tietze happy here by playing into stereotypes. The way our opponent has been described to us makes me think this is a poorly played steal attempt. Normally I'd let him get away with it, but since calling won't hurt us terribly if we're wrong, I'm going to call. And I think that's the big thing, is that you know, if we call and we miss, obviously we lost money, but we're not devastated for the day.
I was thinking that it's a lot of money to call with just a six-eye flush.
Mm-hmm.
And he did play it like he was going for the flush with us when you look at the way he played it up to that point. But I say I'm just glad that we've only invested about $40 here in fold. And if we're wrong, you know, sometimes you have to fold the best hand. You know, we worked really hard to build up that stack, and maybe a bluff, but I like my money, so I'm gonna let this hand go and move on. So that's what you have to do sometimes. Let's see what happens.
Hello again. We're really wishing we had more information on this opponent, and now his appearance offers us no help. We really don't know where we stand. Why the shove? Why did he wait until the river? He looks fairly confident, but he's so statuesque that we can't even get the semblance of a read on him. If we call, and we're wrong, we're still up for the session, but only by about $10. Perhaps he called with King of Spades, Ten of Spades under the gun? If he had that, he'd show for sure. Well, we ultimately decide he may be a savvy opponent, pushing in an overbet to disguise it as a bluff, hoping to snap off two pair. I know. This advanced play isn't seen much at 1-2, but you know me, I like to err on the side of caution. We flash our baby flush and toss it into the muck, much to the table's surprise. This time, our opponent doesn't oblige, but a slight smile spreads across his lips as he tosses his cards into the muck and he rakes the pot. Was this the right move? I guess we'll never know. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, sometimes, doesn't it feel like all you're doing is folding? I hope to see you on the film.
I don't know whether we could rather be truly wrong here, and I know I'm opening up this to some vicious debate here, but regardless of what we did, you know, as you said, we only invested a small bit in this pot, so by not committing more, we save money if we were wrong. If we had called and that smile was a bluff, we would have had a fantastic session. And if we had called and that smile was, he got away from me, then we'd basically be even for the session. But we put our one chips to use trying to win even more. And that's really what you're trying to do at the poker table is, or in business, is build capital and then turn that capital into more. The poker table, you know, get chips and then use those chips to do things you couldn't do without chips to build more. So right. I think that's where this came down to me is that, you know, I don't want to go home even for making a bad call here, but the reason you win chips is so you can put them to use. And you have to do that responsibly. And this is definitely a tough call here to make. But I'm not going to criticize anybody for doing either one of them.
Well, since it's an intangible math coin flip for me to whether or not what that smirk meant, I'll just say that I made the right play and move on in my mind. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say that I made the right play.
Yeah. That's absolutely important because, I mean, you're talking about the psyche here. I mean, the worst thing in poker is not knowing whether somebody got the best of you or not.
Yep.
And you know, if it's on a TV table and 3 months later you can watch and find out, or your opponent is a over generous tweeter, and you know he's going to tweet, "Hey, I just bluffed this guy." That's one thing, but in this situation, I don't know whether we'll ever know. So if you can't ever figure it out, the quicker you put it out of your brain and focus on the next hand and whatever else is what you need to do. If you sit there and dwell on it forever, it's just going to kill you.
Exactly.
So it's been a few weeks since I returned from that absolutely amazing trip to the upper Midwest, and not only did I get to see lots of the United States and spend some time with any of friends, but I got to visit more than 24 poker rooms. And this week and next, I'm going to share some of those stories. This week we're going to talk about South Dakota, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. And then next week we'll talk about Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, and Kansas. And then following weeks, we're going to talk about Vegas when we're out there, of course, which is always fun.
Yeah.
And then I'm headed to New Mexico and Colorado. So consider this the next month, the summer of anti-up travel shows. So if you love traveling, you're going to love this. If you hate it, oh boy.
Sponsored by AAA.
Yeah. we'd get a triptych.
So is this the part of the show where I get to go have some lunch and... And you just talk for about an hour?
I mean, it's going to be boring if I just ramble on without you picking on me.
Okay, I'll do my best to nitpick you.
Yeah, but I got a lot of notes here. I'm going to try to get to them as quickly as possible. But, if there's some fun stuff to follow up with, let me know. But let's start with South Dakota. I was really excited about going to South Dakota. I went there when I was a little kid, and I remember Mount Rushmore. But, you know, when you're a little kid, you can't really, you just go back to school and say, "Hey, I went to Mount Rushmore." You don't really appreciate it, right?
Right, right.
Until you're older. And then, of course, with the poker, new bet limits coming up, it made a lot of sense. And I'm really glad we made that side trip because it's not easy. I mean, first thing, it's not easy to get to Deadwood. Flights are expensive, unfortunately. And I even looked into taking a bus, and that didn't really work out. So, I mean, it was about a 13-hour round trip from the Iowa border.
Man.
So, but beautiful, beautiful Darwin's country along the way. But the poker's in Deadwood. It's a great historical gaming town. It's trying to get back on the map now. They're raising bet limits in the city to $1,000 on July 1st. Currently, it's $100. It started out as $5 back when they brought gaming back. So with $1,000, I think they're going to be more competitive to some of these other jurisdictions. Particularly some of their real feeder markets like Minnesota and Denver, which I'm told have smaller bet limits. So, they're really trying to make a play to get some folks there. And you did an absolute wonderful cover for our next issue of Antiup, which is going to be shipping actually today, right?
I hope so.
So, folks, check that out. We ran a big story with a lot more detail on this. But it's a fun little city there. I mean, lots of history. I'm sure folks know that this is where Wild Bill Hickok was shot, with the famous Aces and Eight, Poker Jane ran card games. One of the first things, we get to town, right, is all excited after the long drive, start walking down Main Street, and look across the street, and I tell my wife, "Hey, there's Saloon Number 10. That's where Hickok was shot." And she's like, "Oh, that's great. That's interesting." We take another walk down the block, and I see a sign, "Here's where Wild Bill Hickok was shot." And I'm like, "Wait a minute." And so this is kind of what's interesting, is the he was shot at what's called the Old Saloon Number 10. And since then, it's new ownership, and it actually has moved across the street where it actually operates now as a casino and a poker room. So that's the first one I saw, but the Old Saloon Number 10 is actually just been sold and for rent right now. So if you go to see it, there's a little sign that says, "Well, Bill Hickok was shot here, 1876. And then, for rent, Century 21. And I thought that'd be awesome if we could actually rent it. Actually rent history. I talked to a bartender that night, and he said, hey, you know, it's the little scene is still pretty much preserved. It's but down kind of in the basement because the city has been devastated by floods and fires over the year, and they just keep building on top of it. So the city's actually higher now than it ever used to be.
Oh, man.
But the marketing folks there in town say that they do think that Yold Saloon will be open soon. And we can only hope that the new owners are going to embrace the history. But kind of, it's a real historical town. So I mean, if you're into history, you have a lot of fun there. The poker, admittedly, is fairly small. There's 5 poker rooms. The biggest one only has 5. There's only 15 poker tables in the whole town. But it's in a tight little touristy cluster. So if you can't find a game in one, you can walk literally a block to the next one and see if you can get a game. 2 to 10 spread limit was the big popular game there. After the limits changed, though, it sounds like some rooms are going to try some of the traditional 1-2 no limit games because they got some more room to play with.
Right.
But I'm a big fan of spread limits, so I had a lot of fun. I know it's not a game that has played a lot of places, but you know, I think it's a good mixture between limit and no limit because you can mix up your bet sizes, so you can pick up some betting. Pattern tells on folks, but at the same time, you're not going to have the jackpot and the 10 seat go all in for $5,000, you know, on your draw.
Right.
The Silverado is probably the best known of them. It hosts the annual South Dakota Poker Championships, which is a $1,000 buy-in event, which is a little bit more than 100 people this year. But the Lodge of Deadwood is the newest. It's got a real modern poker room, and they got some really, really cool promotions. That's one of the fun things, I think, when we travel is, you know, picking up the little flyers.
Yeah.
And seeing what folks do. I mean, Everett talked about how do you do with Aces Cracked. They have 2 things here that I think are absolutely fantastic. One, they do 200% prize pool tournaments. So they actually match the initial prize pool in, I think it's 4 tournaments each week. And the rebuy tournaments, so, you know, the prize pool gets really big for a fairly small field, and they're kicking in, you know, if the entry is $40, they're kicking in $40 of house money.
So it's always an overlay, no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. But the other thing is even cooler, they call it their High Society Challenge, and what they did is they took all 52 cards in the deck, and they assigned a task to it. You know, like having aces cracked or play the Monday tournament or some that are even more difficult, like be seated in a cash game when the bad beat hits. But there's no time limit to complete it. Every time you have one of these, you cross it off your card. And once you've completed all 52 challenges, you win a prize package. It's worth about $5,000, including some cash. They'll do a private stake game for your friends, so they'll put money on the table for you guys. Give everybody in your entourage hotel rooms. Have a chef provide a private dinner for you. And they have some special merchandise. Include a personalized bottle of bourbon, which I think is awesome.
Holy cow.
But, yeah, $5,000, and all you got to do is do it. There's no time limit, so, you know, even if you're a tourist, obviously you're going to need to visit fairly regularly. You can do it. And they do some kind of wild card weekends. So if you show up for one of those, then you get a kind of free pass. So you can scratch off some of those harder to hit ones like the bad beat. But that's pretty cool, I think.
You know? Now, when you mentioned the Silverado's South Dakota Poker Championships and how many people entered it, so they just add tables like a regular poker, you know, tournament would be, and then they just take the tables and get rid of them after that?
No. I think what they do in the... They've got some weird laws on adding tables, but the Lodge does tournaments as well too, and the Cadillac Jacks do. They do a lot of flights.
Okay.
Here, so I think that's probably what they did at Silverado. You know, you have a day 1A, 1B, 1C, maybe 1X for a while. You know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's tough to do a tournament in Deadwood because of the limited number of tables. So
now, do you think that's going to change now with the $1,000?
I don't think so. Unfortunately, you know, when I was talking to folks. I think what they probably thought would be more advantageous is to loosen up the table restrictions, you know, the taxes on them and things like that, because then they would be able to do a big tournament in a traditional format. You know, the limits are one thing. You know, a lot of folks even said, you know, hey, we're not really sure what this means. It's probably going to make a bigger deal on our blackjack tables than it is at the poker tables. Mm. But I know at least one manager said, you know, hey, I really wish we could have got some table relief rather than the bet limit. But, you know, that's what happens when the lawmakers are involved. They think they're helping you, and not that they're not helping them. I mean, it's a great thing to have the bet limits higher, but they could have done more help for them.
Okay.
Cadillac Jacks is also fairly new. They do some daily tournaments, and they got a couple of small tournaments series during the year as well, too. Gold Dust has just two tables. I went in there one night, and both tables were going. But a more older crowd than I thought in other places. I'm not going to call them nits, because that's stereotyping. But then I did play at the Saloon Number 10. A couple times, and you know, I got to town. Everybody said, "Yeah, Saloon Number 10. That's the meat market. That's where everybody goes to have fun." And it was a lot of fun there. The whole place is bustling every night. They have the poker tables right next to the blackjack tables, right in the bar. So, I mean, when you think of the traditional casinos, these are not them. I don't think they're kind of like slot machines and table games built around bars and restaurants. So, yeah. It's kind of a place to hang out. But the first night I got there, I went down, I'm like, hey, you got a game going? And they're like, yeah, we're playing a $2 to $10 spread limit dealer's choice. I'm like, giddy up. Sat down, bought in. And so here's the deal. The dealer button is an 8-sided cube, Chris.
Right? Oh, my God.
So, and they change the game every single hand, you know, just like when they pass the dealer button in a normal game. When you're the dealer, you flip the cube around to whatever game you want to play, and that's what you play for that hand. And some high-low versions are already on the cube, but you can call a high-low of anything else. So I think there's as many as maybe 12 different games in this mix. Hmm. But I've never played a dealer's choice that switched every game, or every hand, I mean. Which I can think some people might find it more annoying. I thought it was kind of interesting. I did quite well. I don't think these people knew how to play most of these games. And I was able to adjust, you know, every single hand without having to get into a rhythm. You know, sometimes, I mean, we'll talk on the next show about the Chicago meetup, but we had some interlopers, and they're talking about how, you know, they kind of need to, you know, get a couple hands in before they get the hang of it again. And you obviously don't have that luxury when you are switching every single time.
That's one question I had is that so it can go from stud to hold'em from hand to hand?
Oh, absolutely.
That would tick people off, wouldn't it? I mean, you got to pay the blinds because some guy calls it. And.
But no, they don't. I think they had a. I'm trying to remember now. I think it was fairly structured. I think they did. I think they might have done just blinds for everything.
Even stud?
Maybe they did dollar ante and no blinds.
Yeah, antes would make more sense because you stud, you get blinds of people who don't have a hand or whatever. That's kind of weird.
I don't know. Whatever it was, I didn't really mind. I was making money. But you're right. I mean, there are weaknesses to this. But, okay. But I think it was kind of cool how they did it. And then they have a game called Super O. And they called that, and I'm like, all right, I know how to play every game that we played tonight. Tell me how to play Super O. And I think they didn't tell me correctly. Because the next day when I walked back, I saw they had a little cheat sheet on the brush stand. And I'm like, hey, that's not how I was playing it last night. But you got three cards, and I played like Omaha, except, so, you know, I thought you could only use two from your hand and three on the board. But I believe when I went back the next day, I read the rules, you can use any combination of the eight cards. So you can play the entire board if you want, or you can use one in your hand, or three in your hand, and that would have made a lot of difference, I think.
Well, so that's Tahoe, but with playing all three cards, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Holy cow.
But yeah, it's always good to be sure you fully understand the new game before you play it. But that was Deadwood. So I definitely recommend it. You know, like I said, it's not easy to get there, but I think, you know, if you're a history buff like I am, you're going to have enough fun and there's just enough poker there to have a good time. You know, it's not like going, obviously, to the Commerce where you got 15 tables in the bathroom. So it's not necessarily a poker destination, but it's a history. And then you're, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes from Mount Rushmore and some of the other historical stuff.
So you follow the news regularly. I don't really read the newspapers anymore. I kind of got out of the business and wanted to stay out. But when we were at dinner the other night with the family, one of the in-laws had brought up that they had struck oil in South Dakota and that there were so many people there with jobs now and everything that they can't accommodate people and they're turning people away to like who want to live there, who want to move and live there. Is that going to have a huge effect, do you think, on on the expansion of the gambling here, and expansion of these poker rooms and everything, because there's so many people that are going to be coming to this town? Or you think that it's...
I can't imagine that they could run out of places for people to live in South Dakota. I mean, we spent 6 hours in the car and we saw seven people.
Yeah. Well, he said that they couldn't build houses fast enough for these people or something, so they're turning them away.
That whatever. Could be. It all depends where, though.
Okay.
Obviously. But another interesting thing is one of the managers, or actually I think the marketing director, of this for the Chamber of Commerce told me that there's a lot of huge energy fields up in North Dakota, which isn't too far.
Okay.
And those people are well-heeled and come down. So, you know, even though you think of it as the middle of nowhere, there's some money at the table. But,
okay.
Yeah, certainly they found oil. That means even more.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That it's going to really boom then if that's true.
No, yeah, absolutely. Of course, it depends where, though. I mean, you know, the state's huge. So,
yeah.
I mean, in terms of land mass, so... And like I said, it's not very easy to get to one side or the other. So, you know, if it's on the other side of the state, that's going to be a bigger boom for other rooms than on the western side.
Okay.
All right, well, we left there and drove a wonderful, joyous 13 hours to Minneapolis.
Oh, man.
Stopped at a couple rooms up in Minnesota. You know, Minnesota, I found, was a lot like Florida. In the sense that poker really is king there, at least the two pari-mutuel rooms in the Minneapolis area. You know, down here in Florida, other than a couple casinos, they don't have slot machines, so it's, you know, 50 tables of poker, and that's what people play.
Yeah.
Up there, now they do have table games, but no slot machines at the pari-mutuel rooms, so poker, I think, does get a little more higher profile, which is nice. You know, you go to a normal casino and it's, you know, the redheaded stepchild in most places, right?
Yeah.
But the rooms have plenty of tables, lots of action. They just raised limits there to $100 per bet, which is going to allow for bigger limit games. But the big change is going to be the ability to add more tables, especially for tournaments. Quite the opposite of what we just said in South Dakota. They can add a bunch of tables now, and then they can add even more for tournaments. So. They'll be able to have, and both of these Running Aces in Canterbury, which I'll talk about, are very big properties, so they have plenty of place to add tables, even if temporarily. So I wouldn't be surprised if we have some really huge poker tournaments in Minnesota coming up soon. I mentioned those two, Running Aces in Canterbury. They're both pretty stylishly designed. Table games are featured, but plenty of room of poker. The next day, I did driving out of town. I went to stop at Treasure Island, which is an Indian casino. It's got a smaller poker room, but it's separated from the casino, which I always like.
Yeah,
I kind of like being close enough to the casino that I feel like I'm at a casino, but not right there where I have a headache from the slot machines dinging all night, right? And this is where it was. It wasn't too far from there, but had its own separate room, which was kind of cool. And of course, the highlight of going to Minnesota was we did the Ante Up meetup there. Started off at the St. Paul Saints game. And I got to say this, it was 37 degrees in Deadwood when we were there.
Jeez.
So cold that the wife had to actually go buy one of those Deadwood sweatshirts to keep warm.
Oh, man.
And then, you know, this was a difficult trip to pack for because I was gone for 2 weeks, right? So we tried to guess as much as we could. So in Minneapolis, every day for about a week before the meetup, it was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Every day for about a week after the meetup, it was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
On the meetup day, when we're outside at a baseball game, 96 degrees. Absolutely. Perfect way for Mother Nature to say, screw you, Scott.
You're going to sweat today.
Yeah. But despite those stifling temperatures, Poker Geek and his wife came out. They're always a lot of fun. They came on one of our last cruises. We had four or five other hardy souls also that braved the temperatures. We did the best we could, but that kind of temperature, our faces were kind of melting off like we're on Raiders of the Last Ark. And so I think everybody kind of looked at each other, and then we started. It was almost like, you know, the chop discussion at a poker tournament.
Yeah.
It doesn't start voraciously. It's kind of like one or two guys going, you know, I can chop if you want to chop. You want to chop? Got to chop. This was like, hey, you know what? We could go to Canterbury right now. We don't have to stay there. I could probably do that. And finally I said, hey, guys, you know, don't feel like I need to stay here for the rest of the game. You know, I'm sweating as much as you are. we want to get up and go to Canterbury right now. Let's go. And everybody's like, yes!
Hey, rumor has it, too, that you were asked to sing the national anthem before the game. Did that happen?
I did. I brought the crowd down. Literally to their knees.
Oh, my God. Begging for you to stop.
I can't be as bad as Roseanne Barr, right?
I was going to say it was reminiscent, probably.
Yeah, reminiscent. But yeah, so we left the baseball game, which was a lot of fun, even though it was hot. I got to Canterbury Park, and of course, we're just a victim of timing at that point. So, you know, I don't know how many tables they have, quite a lot, but they had a lot of cash game action going on. And then they have a 6 o'clock tournament, so they needed to reserve, I think, the 10 tables for that at least. So we weren't able to get a private table together to play cash game like we wanted to. Had we waited, as we found out, probably like an hour later, we could have, because once the tournament started, a bunch of the cash games broke because those people went to the tournament. So a bunch of tables opened up, and then, of course, you know, there's people knocked out of the tournament. But we weren't that smart. So then a couple of folks were like, you know, hey, let's I could play the tournament anyhow. So we all decided to play the tournament, right?
Yeah.
And we entered. One of our guys actually made all the way to the final table, which is cool. We played all night and made about $200. But very cool. Awesome. I, on the other hand, was out about second or third.
Oh, my God.
Not finishing second or third. Out.
Out second or third. Yeah. Third. Oh, my God.
You know what? I don't know whether, you know, this is divine intervention. Not a big fan of that, but I, you know, I'm agnostic. I'm not atheist. I reserved the right to understand that there might be something out there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And our good friend Father Paul, who obviously has different views, I hope, because that's his vocation, right? I was really looking forward to meeting him. We've exchanged emails forever, back all the way back to the TBT days, right?
Right.
And he came out, and he got there, and he's like, hey, did I miss the table? This is about a tournament. I'm like, yeah, hey, sorry. We're all in the tournament. Come over and say hi. We couldn't get a cash game table. So he comes over. Hey, Paul, shake his hand, right? Two hands later, I'm out of the tournament.
That, my friend, is divine intervention.
But wait, it gets worse, right? You know, my draw missed another guy. A guy overplayed top on this draw-heavy board, and, you know, I made the right play. I don't think he did, but whatever. He got my chips, right? So I immediately went over and saw that Father Paul was sitting down. It was at a 3-6 cash game, and had a seat next to him. So I'm like, hey, I'll sit down and play, right? Had a wonderful time chatting with him for the next hour or so. Lost almost all my buy-in before he left. Once he left, though, I moved to a 6-12 game and won everything back that I lost, including my tournament buy-in plus some. I think some kind of force was working against me there, right?
Are you agnostic still?
yes, probably. I'll shave either the A or the C off. I'm a little less.
Well, that's pretty funny.
But no, great guy. All the people that came out were a lot of fun. Really enjoyed it. It's always fun talking about Annie up to the folks and putting faces to names and things like that. And the last funny thing there, too, is the reason that Paul left, actually, was, and, you know, we're sitting there playing, and all of a sudden these alarm bells go off. And it's always reassuring to me when alarm bells go off in a business and the employees don't know what they mean.
Oh, man.
They were like, hey, I've never heard that before. Well, it turns out they had this massive storm that came through, and those were warning signs to let – so they didn't let anybody out because they didn't want anybody driving in this thing because it was blowing high winds and lightning. So they literally locked us all in the casino until the storm passed.
Huh.
Of course, I didn't care. I was in there playing. But, I mean, but what was funny, though, is they had this massive van. The Vans Warped Tour was at Canterbury Park that day outside the big grassy area. And all of a sudden, all these very soaking wet people in shorts were coming into the very air-conditioned inside. And they were hanging out. So not only did you have to keep all of us in, they had to go out and get all those people and bring them in. So it was really wild. But I've never been locked in a casino before. But it was really cool. really different. And, of course, when the storm passed, Paul was like, hey, he had a little Doppler app on his iPhone. Uh-huh. And he's like, hey, I've got a window. I got to go. Got to get home so I don't die. And I'm like, all right. So he took off. But we had a lot of fun there. So we really appreciate the hospitality. And Poker Geek is just a tremendous ambassador for us up there and took care of a lot of the stuff for us. So,
cool. cool.
Had a lot of fun. All right, home stretch here. Went to Wisconsin right after that. Stopped over at Ho-Chunk Wisconsin Dells. Made a quick stop there. They got a pretty large room in the casino. Cordoned off a bit from the rest of the casino, but not its own room. But this room is coming back now, from understanding. It used to be really big, and then they had to shut down for a while. Now they're building it back up. From there, I went to Ho-Chunk Madison. Sean Bauer, the poker room manager there, absolute huge fan of Annie Up. And it's a poker pro table room. At least it was when I was there. Unfortunately, since I left, it sounds like they lost some kind of judgment from the courts, and right now they're going to have to shut down the poker room. I hope they can resolve that, because Sean is such a great guy. And he has the most awesome waiting room ever. We sit there and talk for like an hour or so, and he's like, all right, you want to see this? And we turned the corner, and he's like, you know, hey, for full, this is where we send folks. It's this huge leather sectional sofa. They got TV, satellite TV, I think, the remote control. They got a big water cooler. And it was a totally awesome place to hang out and wait for a table, I think.
Cool.
So I don't know if he gets to keep that in his house now.
So now, really, you could move in, right? Because you got to wait a really long time for a table.
Absolutely. It could be years.
You could fall asleep on that thing for a week.
And it's interesting to talk about the poker pro tables now, because I don't know whether they'll still be there. But obviously, they're at other casinos right now. You know, we talked about Alamod on the show before. I've never been a big fan. I don't think a lot of people were big fans of them. But he gave me a demonstration of them again, and they've come a long way since the last time that I played on, which has been several years, I think. I think the last time I played on one might have been at the Seminole here in Tampa, and that's been three, 5 years, right?
Yeah.
But they have a lot more statistics on them. The play is a little quicker. They actually had a final table area there where they can actually where they beam the actual table images on this flat screen TV so people can watch the action, which is kind of cool. You know, and there are advantages to the Poker Pro, as we talked about before. I mean, no errors, you're not tipping dealers, you get a lot more hands per hour in, but obviously give up some. I mean, some people, you know, you're not gonna, I like stacking chips, you know.
They
can make me actually stack chips with the computer, that'd be a little different, but they have come a long way, so I would encourage folks, if you played them before and haven't liked them and you find yourself someplace and that's all they have, you know, don't necessarily turn your nose up. Give them another shot. I'm not going to say you're going to love them, but I think you're going to like them better than the last time you played. All right, and then the last stop was Pottawatomie, which I couldn't pronounce the first time I went there, but I think I nailed it. And last time I was there, it was down by the bingo hall, but now the room has moved upstairs. It's very stylish, a lot more room. Got a brand new manager there who's taken over and is looking to do some new things. Right now they're limited to the 18 tables in their room, but they're trying to get approval to be able to set up more tables in the event center, which is right across the hallway. And the most interesting thing he was real excited about, he's like, you know what? Hey, we built an extra large table for our Pot Limit Omaha players.
Oh, that's cool.
So I went over and looked at it, and it was... It's not massively huge. It's not like, you know, you're going to have to, like, throw your chips into the pot. But they wanted a lot more room for folks, and they had it specially built. And it was kind of cool. It was just a little bit bigger than the normal table. And they had it right in the center of the room, too. But I hadn't seen that before.
Huh. Very cool.
All right, well, that's it for this week. Like I say, next week we'll talk about Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and some other places. But enjoy everybody came out to see us in Minnesota, and hope to get up there very soon.
Backstage, the girls were playing five cards, stood by the stairs.
Hi, this is Cindy Violet, and you're listening to Annie Up.
Lily had two queens. She was hoping for a third to match her pair.
Okay, our hand of the week this week come from Jacob, I believe from the St. Louis area. And he starts it off, and it made me chuckle. He's like, you know, we all know that casinos are notorious for keeping the rooms at meat locker temperature, right?
Yeah.
So I've often been shaking while making a bet, but only when I have a big hand. I know this shaking is common in the tell of a big hand, but it only seems to happen after I've been folding and I wake up with a hand and I feel my heart race when I see a flop hit. And I try to steady it, but I can't stop it completely. You know, I always wondered about this, because this sometimes happens to me, too. I wonder if people are picking up a tell on me just because I'm freezing. Because I'm one of these people, I mean, I moved to Florida for a reason. I hated the cold, and, you know, it's hard for it to be too hot for me. And going into these poker rooms, I am always shivering. But I thought that was funny that that he mentioned that. But that's not for the hand of the week yet.
Oh, okay. I was writing all these details down, you know.
Oh, awesome, yeah. Okay. Well, obviously, you know, he has a shaking problem.
All right. That helps.
All right, so here's here's the actual hand of the week. He says, I just played in a $60, 50-player max daily tournament at the local Harris there in St. Louis. Blinds start at 100, 200 with 20-minute levels. Players start with 10,000 units. Now, he says, I don't like these fast structures, but it's the only way to keep up practice. Plus, it gets one into to take a few risks here or there due to the limited amount of time that one has to make a play. Since I've been on a run of hands and taken down four of the last few pots, but I've got my stack healthy to make a decent run, somewhere between 26 and 30K.
Okay.
It's the end of level 3, which is 300, 600, and I pick up the Ace of Hearts, Jack of Hearts, in the low jack seat. What's the low jack seat? Is that on the other side of the hijack?
That's just right before the hijack, yeah.
What we call the assassination seat?
Yeah, it's the low jack.
Okay.
So there's the button, the cutoff, the hijack, the low jack. So you're basically in middle position.
Yeah, I kind of like the assassination, though. That's probably too much in your face, right? All right, so he's in the low jack seat. It says there's a limper ahead of him, but it's folded around to him. What do we do, Chris?
You know, it's weird. I don't like ace jack at all. When I was playing online, I lost a lot of money with ace jack.
That's so weird.
Why?
No, you just said this is weird.
Oh. I don't mind limping here. The problem is that when you limp, you don't have any idea if you're up against somebody who's got a decent hand or not, because they'll all just call along, and then you're going to be multi-way pot that's unraised. So, I don't know. I mean, you said it's 300, 600?
It's the end of level 3, so I'm assuming we're still at 300, 600.
Okay. Oh, man. Well, we're on a heater, so, you know, I might as well go with that feeling and raise then. And I probably raised to 2,000.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a theme that comes up in a couple other future hands of the week. And I think you guys probably talked about this, so I know you about the ace queen on some of the shows that I wasn't on.
Right.
But I'm with you. I don't like any of these ace X hands anymore, except for ace king, and I'm not always a big fan of ace king either. The difference I think here is that we're not facing a raise. When we're facing a raise, one of the big leaks I'm plugging now is to fold these hands and not even get involved. Which is kind of overcorrecting, I admit, but it does save me a lot of money until I can become a little bit better player. But this wasn't raised here. We just have a guy limping, which could be anything. So at this point, I don't know if I want to limp and open this up to a lot of people and essentially play for the straight or the flush. You know, if we could raise here, then we can hopefully isolate against this guy. Can't imagine he has an ace. Why wouldn't he raise if he did, if he's first in? That's always kind of fishy, I know. But I feel a lot more comfortable playing ace-jack when I'm the aggressor and heads up. So I think I'm with you. I would normally make this, 3X would be 1,800. Count for the other guy. I might put 2,500 in here. Mm. Really make it tough for somebody else to call.
Yeah.
Still less than 10% of our stack, right?
That's fine, yeah. I mean, I just at least 3.5X I'm going to make it, so.
Yep.
So like 21 or 22, but yeah, 25 is fine too. The thing I always fear of when I have a hand like this and I have a limper before me and if he comes along is that he has like a suited ace like me, and it could be anything. It could be ace 5, and then you never know when you hit your ace if this guy's made two pair, if he's betting strong, or if he doesn't understand how good his hand is and he only has aces with a 5 kicker. And so you got to decipher that the whole way, and it's kind of annoying. So I just don't like ace-jack. I lose money all the time to ace-king and ace-queen with it when I'm playing cash. I just don't like the hand. I just don't. It's one of my least favorite hands of all time. But I agree, we're on a heater. We have the biggest stack at the table, likely. And, you know, we have this sort of image of we can't lose. Why limp when you can probably isolate against people who are probably going to just get out of your way when you're raising? So I will make it, like you said, I'll make it 22 or so.
Yeah, I'll tell you, ace-jack is a lot easier to play when everybody folds pre-flop.
Yeah, everybody.
I mean, seriously, you know, it's. I would rather. The problem with ace jack or ace queen or ace 10, I'm sorry, are these hands are you just never know how to play them on the flop. And you made a great point. It's not only so much hitting your ace, you don't know whether your kicker's good new pair. You know, I would just prefer to never play a post-flop hand, even with Ace King, I think. All right, so our hero says, make the same raises I made the last four hands of 1600. Now, I give him consistency points here because you're disguising your hand now, you know. But that seems a little low to me. But you're going to bet, what, 1800, you said?
Me? No, I was going to bet 22. Yeah, 2022. Yeah. I mean, 1600 is not even 3X, and you have a limper. So you're really pushing the boundaries here to let the big blind in for a real cheap price. And even the limper now to come back in because you've only made it, what, 2.5 or whatever, 2.75 of the size of the big blind. So that, to me, is inviting trouble rather than eliminating trouble.
Now, what do you think? It says if you've raised four hands in a row with 1600, now all of a sudden you're raising a 22-hander.
That's a good point, but there's a limper, and so I don't think it says anything. I think you're accommodating the limper, so I don't think it means anything. If you don't do that ever with limpers, then I think that there's a tell on you there that you don't, you know, you don't really know what you're doing, or that you're not accounting for them, so maybe you don't understand the game completely or the odds completely or whatever. So you might want to adjust your game there. But I don't think it says anything because we had a limper ahead of time.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, so it goes to the button who raises to 4,000. Now, he says this player has already taken out three other players and is the chip leader.
Okay.
He's been hit in the head with the deck with jack-jack, queen-queen, and king-king. It says the hands even came in that order, although they were spread out. That's pretty nice. He looked at three big pocket pairs over the course of a couple hits.
Yeah.
The blinds fold, the limper folds, and it's back to us. For what? Or 2,400?
Yeah, I think the cards hit the muck pretty quick. I don't care what kind of odds I'm getting on my money. I'm out of position now the rest of the way, and this guy re-raised. We're generally just crushed. That range crushes us, especially when he's picked up all these hands too. So he's probably not doing it with 7-8.
He's got us. He's got more chips than we do too.
Yeah, he's got us covered. We're out of position, and he re-raised our raise, knowing that we won a lot of pots too. And we're probably the second biggest stack at the table, so he's not fooling around, and he has our range crushed here. So his range crushes us. I mean, so I don't like this at all. I don't want to be dominated. Plus, you got to think too that limper could have a baby suited ace, so one of your aces are gone if you need it.
Yeah.
So I think on my hand, even though let's see, he made it four, so it's another three.
Should be another 2,400.
Right? Or 2,400 to us, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
About 10% of our stack.
And there's, we made 16, there was 9, that's 25 in the pot, plus a limper is 31. So, yeah, we're still getting a good amount on our money, but I don't think it's enough to get into trouble over, you know, out of position the whole way. If I'm in position, I might take a flyer on this. Because I can afford it,
and you control it.
But I can't control anything here, and this guy's telling me a lot of stuff with this re-raise, I think.
Because, I mean, at this point, this is what I don't like about these hands. Now, with this raise, he's reduced us to playing for the straight or the flush.
Yeah.
And that's really unlikely that you're going to flop that. So that means you're going to have to put in another big bet, even if you hit two of your cards.
Yep.
And hope you hit the turn. If you miss then you're going to be put to another test. Or probably another big bet, the hope you get lucky on the river, and if you miss in the river, then you're screwed, and all of a sudden you look down and you have no chips. So I like to avoid that trouble right now. I mean, I don't like to give up my 1600, but I'm going to have to know that I can really outplay this guy, and it doesn't seem like we can or we have that confidence right now. So I'm going to fold and wait for the next hand.
Well, you made a great point, too, about the flop bet. Think about that for a minute. The odds of you actually flopping Broadway or flopping the actual nut flush, it's just not going to happen. And to play hoping that happens is just bingo poker. So think about it now. You make the call here. There's 10 grand in this pot, and you even if you get a flush draw, you know what he's betting. He's going to bet 10 to 12 or 15,000 on this flop. And now that's you're down to, if you call this, you're down to possibly 22,000. And if you call this, and now he's betting 10, huh?
Yeah, or you're shoving the bluff.
Yeah, it's you just
admit it.
When Lee's on the show and everybody talks about how brilliant he is, one of the things that he always says is you want to make, easy decisions, and you want to be able to make easy decisions, and you want to put yourself in a position to make easy decisions. I mean, did I say position? Decisions. And that's the thing here, is that these are all going to be tough decisions, and one of them is going to be a bingo call, really, and you just don't want that. I feel like you need to be in a good position all the time when you're playing marginal hands, if you're going to play marginal hands. And this is just going to be trouble for him, I think.
And people that have you outshipped, too, I think.
You know, yeah, there's a lot to worry about here.
Yeah. All right, so our hero says, I'm thinking I need to raise again or fold. He says, I only see this guy shoving if I raise again, so I opt for the first mistake and just call.
I have two decisions. I make the third one.
At least he knows he made a mistake. Understanding it is the first part to preventing it in the future. Right?
That reminds me of that sticker I saw that reminded me of you. There are three kinds of people in this world. Those who are good at math and those who aren't. That's what this sounds like. This sounds just like that.
Or it could sound just like us.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so the pot's 9,500. We are heads up, and the flop comes jack of clubs, nine of clubs, three of spades. And we are first to act, and we have the proverbial top.
Yeah, this is where you get into trouble.
We seem to be lacking a lot of hearts.
This is where we get into trouble. Hey, what if he has queens, kings, or aces?
Or jacks, which is...
the case jack there coming on flop. But even nines, you know, it's possible. This is crazy now, because now you got top, but you've paired your jack, which is the one thing you don't want. And the other thing you don't want is to pair your ace, because you got the bad kicker. So either way, you're in trouble here. It'd be different if you had re-raised and gotten him out, and you're up against the limper. But it's the other way around now, and I just don't know what to do here. Maybe you can try to keep the pot small and see what he bets here. I just don't know. I mean, I don't think I'm going anywhere now, and this is what gets you into trouble, because you got top, like you said.
Yeah.
Betting out is kind of... It's a donk bet, they say. That's what they call it. It's not a really great play here. Check raise might be a good play, hoping he has ace-king. But with your luck, he'll have ace-king of clubs, and he'll shove on you or something.
Yeah.
You know? I just don't know how to play this now. I don't, especially when it was a re-raise, I would not have been in this position. So I think I'm going to check and see how much he's willing to bet and take it from there.
Yeah, this is a tough situation because we did raise pre-flop. I mean, we got re-raised. So by betting out is kind of showing the guy, hey, I think I've got some of this, and you don't, which is interesting. Now, if he raises on top of you, now you've lost that money. Now, if you just check and he continuation bets, then you could check raise and really prove your point, but then you've committed even more money with top pair, top kicker. I don't know. I mean, again, I mean, we get ourselves into a situation where it's real difficult, and that's exactly what you're saying, at least. I mean, don't get yourself in this difficult decision.
It'd be so much easier if you were in position, because here, let's say you make a bet and he calls. Now on the turn's a rag. Are you going to bet again? What did he call with? And if you bet again, there's no difference. If you just check, he'll take it away from you, and you don't know where you are. You have no idea what's going on in this hand. This is a brutal hand, and I really wish we had folded preflop. And also, too, let's say you bet. 9,500 is in the pot. An acceptable bet here is like 7,000, 6,000. So 6,000 from your what is now a 22,000 stack or so, you're down to 16,000 in chips. You know what I mean? You went from having almost 30,000 to having 15,000 in a blink of an eye, and all you have is jacks. It's a lot of chips. It's almost half your stack by the time you're done with that bet and calling the preflop bet, and you're nowhere in this hand. I don't know. I think I'm gonna check and see what this guy does.
I think we both would have folded, so here I'm just trying to get to the end as cheaply as possible, knowing that this guy's going to play back. I mean, he's going to put a bet in here. If he doesn't, he should. Hopefully it's a real small bet, and maybe I'll reconsider, but really, I want to be done with this. I want to move on to the next hand and just lick my wounds, so I don't think I'm going to put any more in this pot. All right, so our hero says, when I'm out of position, I like to remain in control as much as I can. This leads to my second mistake of betting 4,000. In hindsight, I should have checked or shoved here. Shoving would have been my option.
Hmm. Well,
yeah. I mean, shoving shuts down the action at that point. At least you don't have to make another mistake the rest of the hand.
Right, but it's probably the biggest mistake you could make if you shove here and he's got queens, he's not folding. Or kings or aces or pocket nines or pocket jacks. So you're only going to get called by a better hand there. I don't like that proposition. Yeah. I really don't want to risk what would now be almost 10,000 on this hand with jacks. And then if I shoved, you know, it's my whole stack on jacks. You know, and this guy has something, he's going to call.
Not a lot of backup. If the tray and the nine were hearts, then it's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
We have no backup here other than the you know, hit an ace or jack or running cards to really improve.
I mean, I like the idea sometimes of betting out because you're forcing them to a decision if they didn't hit this at all. But once they did hit it, and they don't need to hit it, and he could just call here, and then you're stuck again on the turn. Now what do you do on the turn when a deuce of spades comes? Then what do you do? Now you're betting again? You know what I mean? You're really betting again when this guy's slow playing his kings against you, thinking he's hoping you have ace-jack here. The only difference is the only hand that he's losing to there is aces, really, in a set, and you're not going to be betting a set when this guy showed strength pre-flop, so you're probably going to milk him for what you can. So I just feel like we're just making mistakes hand over fist here.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. Yeah, you said it very well, I think, that I think any chips we're putting in here, even if you make the $6,000 or $7,000 bet you want to make, I don't see him folding to that when he re-raised me, right?
Yeah.
So we know we're going to get called, at least, if not raised, and probably no information there. So, I mean, you bet for two reasons, you know, one to build value or two to get your player to fold. So one of those options is taken off the map for you, unless you do shove, like you said. But then that way you're just, you know, you're hoping for B6 to come out of the next hopper. and then, you know, if he calls, then what do you do on the turn? Then you got to slow down, and then he takes it from you, or you got to keep betting with nothing. It's just terrible. Absolutely terrible to be out of position here.
Yeah, ace-jack's a bad hand.
Let's just check it down. Hope we can check it down. I know we're probably not going to be able to, but in the future, you know, we're going to play in position.
Yeah, there's other things, too. I mean, you can represent other hands on the turn if you check call. You know what I mean? Not that I don't know if this guy's savvy enough to pick up on it, but I mean, really, if a club came or a 10 came, you know what I mean? And you could have very well had king queen, and now you could represent that. You
or
know what I mean?
They're clubs, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think at this point, it's nice that we have the jack because we actually have something now. But now you're right. I think now we need to probably, if we're going to play this hand out, we're going to have to represent something we don't have.
Yeah.
If we check here, let him bet, hopefully it's a fairly, maybe he makes the same bet we did, 4K here, which, you know, at that point maybe you take a flyer, and then you're hoping the club comes, and then you can represent the clubs and maybe take it down from him. I think that's the only way you can really win this hand.
I agree.
But that's a dicey proposition. Now you're putting money in on a hand that you're representing a hand that you don't have.
Right, that's what I'm saying. If you're going to try to play this hand, don't play it on your own value. Play it on what you're playing accordingly. And if you did have ace king of clubs here so far, you would be playing it this way up to the 4,000 bet. You may bet out with the four ace king of clubs, you may not. You may check raise with ace king of clubs, and then when the club comes, you can go. So there's a lot of ways to think about it. Okay, I'm not really playing it for the jack, I'm playing it for the pot and the person. So I just feel like the bet out here is not going to be a good thing.
All right, so our opponent calls our bet of 4K. So the pot is 17,500. The turn is the 8 of clubs. So the board now is jack of clubs, 9 of clubs, 3 of spades, 8 of clubs. So straight and flushes get there. And again, we're our first act.
Ah, man. Well,
it's hard for us to represent the flush of the straight now since we bet out, right?
Right, because we bet out. I mean,
that doesn't mean that we couldn't have it, but I mean it's harder for us to represent it.
Right, and it's not that if you had ace king of clubs and that flop came, you might have bet out. But I don't know. You probably wouldn't have. You probably would have check raised, or you would have just check called. And I don't know. I mean, some people bet it out. I mean, I like to bet my draws, but lately they haven't been coming, and I like to do it when I'm in position, not out of position. So I really don't know. I think that if we had check raised and then the 8 came, it would have been different, but we didn't do that. We just bet and called. I don't know. Maybe we... See, that's the thing, is if you check now, he can represent the flush draw. if he doesn't have it, and bet out. And then where are we with just jacks on this super coordinated board? I don't know. I feel like I'm done with this hand. I'm going to check.
Well, and the pot is almost the size of our stack now, too. So yeah, we're getting to the point where any bet, we got to get the chips in. Even if we bet less than that and he raises at this point, at that point, you got to hope that you're lucky your pot committed. So
yeah.
It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal. All right. Well, our hero says, now I feel trapped, but I could get away from this hand at this point. Well, you can get away from the hand at any point if you really want to.
Yeah.
And he bets another 4,000.
Well, even now you're not betting enough if you're going to bet. I mean, if you're going to bet, that's not enough.
I mean, 4,000, that's inviting him to stick around.
Yeah, with a single club in his hand.
Yeah, it's not going to pressure him. I mean, again, those are chips that are, I hate to say wasted, but they're really not being used very effectively.
Right, exactly. That's exactly it.
At 4K, you're putting it in. He's probably going to call with almost anything at that point. So all you've done is build a pot where you hope you can win, and that means you're either going to have to shove on the river and get him to fold, or hope that your jack is good enough. And neither one of those are great options, I don't think. So, I mean, that's 4K. That's I think you're just wasting at that point.
Especially if he raises, then what are you going to do? Now you've lost that $4,000 on top of it. I feel like I want to be done with this hand. I know we have top pair, top kicker, but look at that board.
Yep.
Three to a straight, three to a flush, and plus, like we said, the way this guy played it, it could very well be queens, kings, or aces, or a set somewhere, and he's just milking it, And then, even so, you bet $4,000. What if he has, ace, jack, like you, but he has the ace of clubs in his hand? Now you've given him a perfect price to call and make the flush on the end. So, it's just not a good bet, I don't think.
Yeah, I think these 4K bets, and I admit I've made these size bets a lot in my poker career because I play scared, and I think it shows that you're scared at this point. I mean, why are you betting 4,000 into a pot of 17,500 and leaving only, about 14K behind? At 18K, I mean, I don't know whether players are that advanced in a $60 tournament to think you're post-oak bluffing here. I think it just looks it looks scared, and if I have you out ship, which this guy does, and I don't know by how much, I might just shove right there, and you're probably going to fold because I caught you being scared. So
yeah,
I mean, be bold with your bet or not.
Yep.
All right, so we bet the 4K, and our opponent just calls.
Ooh. Again, we get no information. Now he could be calling for a whole different bunch of reasons.
That's not true. The information we're getting is it is gorgeous to be in position.
That's right.
It's a constant lesson that when you're in position, you could just drive people crazy.
Pot control 101.
All right, so the pot is up to 25,500. We have 14K left in our stack. The river is the tray of diamonds, so our final board is jack of clubs, nine of clubs, tray of spades, eight of clubs, tray of diamonds, so not only are there flushes and straights out there, now there are boats and quad possibilities. And we, of course, are first to act.
Well, I was done with this hand before. This didn't change my hand, so it didn't improve it, really, because, yeah, you got jacks and trays, but it didn't improve your hand. You know what I mean? It's the same thing. You're still behind or you're still ahead, one or the other. It didn't help. So, I'm checking again. I mean, what else can I do?
Here's the other thing. We got 14K left, all right? We're pretty miserable now. We started between 26 and 30K, so we lost about half our stack, right?
Right.
But we have 14K. It's 300, 600. He says the end of the level. I'm assuming it's going up to 400, 800.
Mm-hmm.
We still have a lot of play left on our chip stack, right?
Yeah, we have like 15 big blinds or whatever.
So really the option now is, do we want to shove this 14K into a $25,000 pot that this guy's called all the way, and he's probably going to call, and I just don't think we have any fold equity here, so this guy's going to call, and if he's going to call, he's got his beat, right?
Mm.
It's very hard to imagine that he doesn't have his beat. So at this point, I'm just going to say, oh my god, I made 100 mistakes here, but I've got a decent stack, I can build it back up. I'm just not going to put those back in. This is what we have this going on the forum about tournament survival, and I think this is the thing where somebody says, oh, hey, if I shove here and I'm right, then all of a sudden I got massive, massive chips. Well, that's great, but what are the odds of you actually being able to win with that shove here? I think they're really slim. At the same time, 14K does not leave you terribly short-stacked. You've got a lot of play left, so let's just recognize that we made a lot of mistakes here. We lost half of our stack. And get up, walk around, get a Coke, put a smile on our face, come back, and play good poker again, knowing that we're alive. I think this is a suicide mission, throwing 14K and trying to win a huge pot.
The funny thing is that, and we don't know what the other guy has yet, but they're both sort of in the same position if they don't have the nuts. And in our position, if we check and then call a bet, it's only a bluff catcher. We're only really catching a bluff. You know, I mean, at this point, I would even consider pocket queens betting out here being a bluff because there are so many hands that beat it. And then the other way around, too, is if we bet and the guy calls, he's really only calling a bluff because if he doesn't have the nuts, you know, in a straight or a flush or something. So no matter what this guy has, unless it's pocket jacks or a full house or whatever, they're both in sort of a bluff-catching mode here. So it could be playing chicken, whoever wants to bet first, and see if the other person will call a bluff. So there may even be a reason to shove here, you know, because you don't believe this guy's going to call. But
I don't know what this guy could have. You know, if he was on any kind of draw, he got there. Whether it's clubs or the straight, he got there. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to stick around after the turn on... There's no draw left, right?
Right. Well, if he had the ace of clubs, jack of diamonds, I mean, he could have had ace jack, called it all the way. Now he has the club draw until the river.
Okay. All right. I'll give you that.
Other than that, really, like you said, there's very little. You could have pocket kings in your hand with a king of clubs, but when you shove, you are beating him to the punch, and he has to have the nuts or a very good strong hand to call you. It feels like so. Yeah. You can't win, but.
Alright, so, no, alright, you're right. I'll concede that there is a possibility that you could win here. I mean, I guess this is the calculations that go on in my tournament survival. I mean, what are the odds that he's going to call here or fold here? I think it's fairly thin that he's going to fold. But it doesn't really matter at this point, because if I fold, I have complete control over what's going to happen to me, right?
Mm.
If I fold, I know I've got 14K left. We're going to 400, 800. I could. If we shove, we are. It's a risk, right? We're calculating a risk that, you know, he has one of those hands where he still was just sticking around to the end, and now he can't call that, and then we're going to have a lot of chips, which is great. I'm not saying that's wrong. But if we're wrong, then we're out, and our options are cut off in the end of level 3 of this tournament. Now, again, it's a $60, 50-player max. I'm assuming they only play cash or pay 5 down and 4 and 5 or slightly more than your money. So you do have to play to win this thing. And I guess at this point, you know, that's a lot of chips. So I'm not going to criticize anybody for raising here or shoving here and hoping to get lucky. But I think we made a lot of bad positions, and I think it's level 3. We have plenty of time to find better spots to chip up. Because remember, in these are the kind of tournaments I play all the time. And eventually it gets to the point where the last 12 people, it becomes a shove fest anyhow. Which is good and bad. But you're going to be able to get these size pots a lot more in the tournament. So I think right now people are like, oh my God, that's a huge pot. We need to win it now. I don't think so. Eventually, you know, it's going to take one pot, and you're going to double or triple that later on.
Hmm.
I'm going to play the survival game here. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do. The way he's played it all the way, and I'm down to like 14,000 chips. You're right. I have what amounts to about 14 or 15 big blinds, I guess, on the next blind level. Maybe a little more. I don't know. I just... Well, like I said, if you get a really strong impression that this person is just trying to make his pocket kings a flush on the end here, you know, if you've gotten that feeling, because that could be the hand that he's playing here. If you look at it with pocket kings would re-raise, pocket kings with a club might just call there, and then on the turn he might just call again because now he's picked up the flush draw and he's playing it conservatively. And then on the river, he didn't get his flush, but he does have pocket kings. That's the hand that you might be able to get to fold because so many hands beat kings. I know I realize what you're saying, and I'm totally on board with the survival thing, but there is the other side of the argument saying, I bet it the whole way. I was the one that reached preflop. I could still have aces with the ace of clubs, and this guy could have kings, and he could finally wake up and realize that even if he calls, he's catching a bluff or a worse hand. So yeah. I guess it just depends how important that $60 is to you, and the decision is, you know, to get a big stack now. You know, I don't know.
We're missing some important. We don't know how many chips our hero had, right? I'm looking through.
Right. He said he was bigger than him, though, so it was at least 30, right?
Yeah. But I mean, if it's if he had 32,000, then he's in the exact same situation we are. If he had 50,000, yeah, it's different, you know, yeah, and that makes a decision on how likely he is to make this call for the same reason.
That's but true. Yeah, if he has like 32, then he's the one that's going to be really, really crippled. But if an all-in still gives him 20 grand left, yeah, it's not that big of a deal to him. So, yeah, that would weigh in my decision, too. I think at this point now I'm just going to check because I don't know what that guy has for chips. It's hard to make that decision and see what happens.
And, you know, if he has missed that,
he might check, you know, too.
He might check, too. He may not showdown want to take the shot of the same thing that we're anguishing right now. And, you know, depending what he has, you know, if you're right, if he has the ace king of clubs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have that beat, right?
Yep.
Not if he has pocket kings or queens, then we don't. But
we've saved some money on the end, and he might, like you said, he might do showdown value and just say, yeah, hey, you know what, I'm happy with just winning the pot here with kings if that's good enough. So,
right, that's true. We saved the 14K.
Yeah,
right.
That could weigh in on their decision and his decision and what you should do. So I'm just going to check and see what happens.
All right, well, our hero does shove his last 14K. The opponent goes in the tank, spends about 5 minutes hanging out in the tank.
Hmm.
Finally says, I just can't lay this hand down. So our hero is like, I know my hand may or may not be the best hand, but at least I've got him thinking that he's beat. This makes me think that my hand is good. If he had the straight flush or flush or full house, then it's an instant call. Even on this level play, a made straight is a quick call. Our opponent finally calls, turns over a black queen 10.
Oh, he has straight.
So I know it was not two clubs, but I'm sure one of his cards was a club or both spades. I would imagine one probably was a club, right? That makes it a little easier to stick around.
But, he had the queen 10. He had opened it in a draw and then hit it on the turn. So
right.
Wow, a re-raise with queen 10. See, that's what's so hard about doing these hands, because you really don't... I don't really know what this guy plays like. There's no way for him... I don't think he even told us, either. He just said that he was chip leader. But he didn't really tell us how he played or what kind of player he was, and he may not have known. That's why it's so hard to put him on queen 10.
It's tough to put somebody on a re-raise with a queen 10 on the button. And then that flop, you're open-ended, of course, that plays out at that point. But at that point, I'm not putting anybody on queen 10 at that point.
And that probably explains why he didn't raise when he hit the 8, because the club draw now, he could be right, still not with the nuts, so yeah, I that's why I never shoved there. I mean, there's the only reason I would shove there is if I knew this guy couldn't lay it down, or if he didn't have a straight or a flush. If I felt like he had kings or something, he could lay it down, but no one's going to lay a straight down there with that much money in the pot and your chip leader at the table. I just don't think you're going to.
No. Now our hero says, I'm out of the tournament once again through my over-aggression. I know that I made a few key mistakes and should have re-raised pre-flop and tried to take it down after the flop with a shove. I've often bet myself out of a tournament. I don't slow down enough at times to evaluate the hands. I rope-a-dope myself into betting other people's hands for them. It's by far my biggest leak and the main reason I bust out. I've had more success in attaining chips when I'm aggressive, but I don't slow down and I hit the same dead end.
Well, I have to disagree with the first part of that when he said that he should have re-raised. You're only saying that because you knew he had queen 10. That's results-oriented, right?
Yeah.
And you didn't know he had queen 10, and what if you do a re-raise and he has the aces or the kings, or even ace king, and he shoves over you, or re-raises again? Are you going to get involved with ace jack there? No, the real play there probably is to lay down the ace jack. Sorry that you would have laid down the best hand pre-flop, and you had the best hand post-flop, but on that turn you didn't, and you lost a lot of money. You lost your entire tournament on ace jack, out of position. on a coordinated, unbelievably coordinated board. Straight flushes are there, flushes are there, straights are there, full houses and quads are all there, and you put your entire tournament life on the line with top. And that's tough to swallow.
Well, I'd be interested, now that we know what our opponent had, whether we had checked, as we suggested on the river, whether he would have put a value bet in there.
Yeah. Well, he took 5 minutes to decide to call with a straight, so he might not have. He might have just said, oh, I got a straight.
It is pretty fishy, though, if you had a hand that can beat the straight there, not to bet that river, right? I mean, I guess you could be scared of a boat at that point, but... And we did call,
or flush.
I mean, yeah.
And the flush, you might have been afraid of the flush too, because if we checked, we're saying that we're afraid of the full house.
We could have a weaker flush.
And have
too,
a weaker flush. So
scared that you have a bigger flush and check. Yeah, I guess you're right. So yeah. But yeah, you know, I think Jacob's on to something to some extent. You know, being overly aggressive. Again, I think this was a survival consideration hand here, and I know there's some people out there that'll probably disagree and say, hey, we need to get it all in there, and if we got it in and won, we got 50K, and then we're off to the races. But, you know, I just think even in, we figure at 800, you still have about 17 and a half blinds, which isn't terrible, but it's not short stacked either. You had a chance to stay in this tournament and build it back up. And the point I was trying to make before, too, is, you know, eventually, with 17 and a half, now you've got some fold equity. I mean, you're probably not going to shove it all with 17 and a half big blinds, but you could shove on the flop and take down a lot, and all of a sudden you've chipped up pretty quickly. It's only going to take a hand or two to get back to where you were.
You still have enough chips to do damage and to be intimidating with it, you know, and to make people think, at least. That's still enough chips to do that. I mean, to go from 17 to 30,000 is not easy. It's not going to be easy for him. I have to say that, because that's what he started with, was between 26 and 30. You know, if you from 14 or whatever it was to 30 is not easy. You're doubling up, and it's not easy to double up in tournaments unless you're shoving and getting calls.
No, but if you get a single caller on a flop with a legitimate raise,
right,
and take down on the flop, you've just added about 3K to your stack right there.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's you're right. It's not 30K, but that's 17. And then now at 17, you've got a little bit more confidence. So now you're up to 20 big blinds, 20 couple big blinds, and it changes the dynamic of the tournament.
Yeah.
You know, I had one of those. I was fairly short stacking this tournament this week, and made one of those plays where I picked up. I got a guy to call me pre-flop. I took it down on the flop, and when I raked in the chips and counted them up, all of a sudden I was above 20 big blinds again. And I'm like, great, I'm not short stacked anymore. I don't have to feel now. I can play poker. That it only takes one or two hands like that. So.
Yeah.
Not trying to make it too easy, but I'm also trying to remind people that, you know, particularly later in a tournament, probably not level four, but later in a tournament, there are very few hands that go to showdown, except for all ins.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that raise and take it, or raise, call, and take it down on flops. And those aren't big, those aren't home runs, but those are singles, and they add up, you know.
Well, I think the lesson learned here is if you're out of position, ace-jack is definitely not the hand you want to have, especially to a re-raiser, to your raise. They're telling you, I mean, whether he did or not, he's telling you that he's in position, he's a chip leader at this table, and he's likely got a better hand than you. And from there on, you just don't know where you are the rest of that hand. And it cost him his tournament, which is really terrible.
Yeah. All right, Jake. Well, we appreciate you sending the hand, being honest about your mistakes in it, and hopefully you learned something from it. We are going to send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for the Apple products from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. Go download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store. And send us your hands of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com.
Don't forget to tune in next week for part two of Scott's trip through the Midwest. And then after that, we'll be talking about our Vegas trip. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables. We'll be right back.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.